Here we go. Folks, this is your host, Cameron Ivey of Privacy Please, and thank you so much for tuning in each and every week. If this is your first time, welcome to the show. Tell your friends about it if you like it. If you don't, let's just pretend you didn't listen to it. Thanks again for coming in, and we hope you enjoy the show.
I am messing with you.
How are you, Rob? It's nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you all as well.
Excellent. That's a nice headset. What do we do? A little flight simulation action on the side there? Some gaming? What's that rig?
Yeah, actually, so, you know, just like every other middle-aged dad, like you're trying to sneak away from the kids to, you know, do a little gaming with your boys, but because everybody has, you know, professional schedules.
Yeah.
You get like a 4-hour window, so 20 minutes everybody can play. Yeah.
I like it. See, I'll tell you, I don't play a ton of video games, but I've gotten hooked on Fortnite over the last, like, 2 years, and that's one of the reasons I like it. I play Battle Royale. All I need is 20 minutes. That's it. 15. Like, I can get in and out of a game, start to finish.
That gets your fix, and you're good.
20 minutes. That's it. Like, I've got Final Fantasy on, what's the little mobile thing there, the Nintendo Switch, and, like, you know, that's just a 10-hour commitment.
Sorry about that, guys. No. I realized I was on a less reliable network. So as you can imagine, I am a cyber guy, so I got like 5 networks in my home.
I appreciate
sure
it.
If I don't count
my pineapple, I only have 2. So there is a pineapple live sitting in the other room though. There's all kinds of fun and shenanigans that happen. I can't remember. So I bought a bunch of equipment. I bought a bunch of Hack 5 equipment right before the pandemic hit because we were going to run some experiments. I was running research at the time. And then the pandemic hit. So I'm sitting on an extra stockpile of wireless in particular hacking equipment. I've got a bunch of turtles and all kinds of things just laying around now waiting for me to return to the wild.
Waiting.
See how that goes. But your audio looks good now. I mean, sorry, your video looks good now. Audio's coming in all right. Cam, how's mine? Other than the fact that I should relocate the mic a little closer and just kind of do this thing.
Yeah, right? No, you sound good. Rob, you sound really loud on my end.
No worries.
That's true. You are coming in a touch loud.
I can adjust it here, but I'd rather see if you can adjust it on your end first.
Okay. How about, I'm still showing.
Yeah, that's
really
better.
Loud.
That's better.
That's pretty good. I'm afraid, though, that you're going to get excited and it's going to go up, though, because the thing you just did was you just got calm, right? To see if that lowered your voice. And that's not going to persist over the next 45 minutes, my friend. That's not going to.
No.
I'm going to get rid of
that.
When
I was in the military, I used to march. So when you're in full formation, hundreds of people in line. And so you learn to speak from your diaphragm of just out.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I was one of, my mom is one of 7, and so there are also a lot of grandkids and cousins. So you equally learn to speak from the diaphragm when you've got a house of like 25 people. Yeah. From down here, it's the old Eddie Murphy joke. I forget, it's one of his old movies. Anyway, we'll keep this moving before I botch this any further.
Well,
Rob, nice to meet you.
So you just botched it on recording. So
oh no, I know. I've been on this show once or twice before. I know exactly what's happening at the moment, my friends. I'm intimately familiar.
I didn't
familiar.
Want to make that mistake before again. So.
I'm intimately familiar, and what he's referring to, Rob, is that we kind of naturally just start the show, we just do because. That's what people are tuned in for, is to kind of hear us.
The nonsense.
The nonsense.
And the good.
Yes.
And the good.
They're here for the shenanigans. They're here for the shenanigans. And if they learn something about privacy and security, then they feel as though their time hasn't been a complete waste. So we try to provide that public service whereby we offer shenanigans with a healthy dose of security and privacy. So to that end, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague here, and we'll do the do.
We good?
We're good.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Privacy Please. I am your host, Cameron Ivey, and with me, as always, Mr. Gabe Gums. Gabe, how you doing, man? This is not Friday, but it's a good Monday.
You know, it's close enough to Friday, however, that I'm still feeling good. How's that?
Yeah.
As long as we don't... Yeah, I'm going to get towards that middle of the week thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not Sunday. You know, like, the worst is Sunday night after football's all done and you got to wake up and work in the morning. But at least you don't... Some of us don't have to actually drive to work. All of us,
that's
at
fair.
Least.
That's fair.
Which is nice, I guess.
Yeah.
But see, we do have...
Huh? I'm sad I don't have that problem. I like Sundays and...
I do, too. I was just trying to
I love Sundays.
I was trying to fight it.
Did I just completely ruin it?
No,
we have
good.
A guest today. Is there anyone else that we'll be talking with?
We do. He's being very patient. Rob Oden, he is a senior manager for, I don't want to even mess this up. It's L. Harris Technologies. L3 Harris Technologies. So your senior manager, data protection and investigations team. So first of all, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time and really excited to get to know you.
Okay. Yeah. I'm really excited to be part of this, really fun discussion.
Awesome.
Or whatever the journey that Gabe is going to take us on.
Yes. He's got some things up his sleeve. I know that. if you just want to kind of start the show off for us, Rob, just like all of our guests, just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you came from.
Absolutely.
And how you got to where you are.
Okay. Yeah. So I am a 17-year IT and cybersecurity professional whose experience has primarily been DoD, Fed space, and aerospace and defense, with a specialization in data protection. More of your traditional data classification, categorization, all of that, IRM, and insider threat. So the individuals who we entrust with authorities and to do things, potentially doing something in a way that weren't included or intended to. And it's funny, a lot of how I've got to where I was the right opportunity at the right place. And even in one instance, being the wrong person in the right place. They called a Robert, and I said, yeah, and that's how I got into cybersecurity. I go into the wrong interview. It's been an opportunity for just really just kind of being open. A lot of professionals in the Air Force, I signed a line, and they're like, yeah, that's nice, and this is what you're going to do. I just so happened to be lucky to do something I really enjoy, which is IT system integration, kind of solving really challenging problems. And then with that, I was able to transition into the intelligence community and, you know, learn about, you know, protecting information at different levels. And then as a kind of a natural segue, being more of the who's dealing with the information. And then obviously for this call, balancing out the individualism, right, with the organization. So it's not, even in the federal government, you can't just completely forget about the individual or their individual civil liberties or privacy or the things that there's an expectation of, hey, I'm going to be treated at least certain level of respect, and having to balance that with kind of our capabilities. And so that's got me to my latest position as a data protection and investigation team lead, as well as the senior architect for L3 Harris for data protection and insider threat initiatives.
Rob, I wasn't going to mention it, but your last name is pretty close to Ogden. And we originally sent the email to rob.ogden.
Yes.
But we accidentally sent it to you, and so that is also how you ended up on the show. It was also we called the wrong Rob.
It's apparently, like I said, I was getting out of the military, and you know, I was doing a big hiring for a defense contractor, and they called a Robert, and you know, I stood up, and it wasn't about till halfway through the interview where they were like, like when the hiring manager said, well, okay, I think you got the technical spot down. Can you go into your compliance experience of leading compliance efforts? I'm like, I've never led a compliance effort in my life. I've helped.
But it,
like, that's not what your resume says. Your resume says you have 7 years. Like, handed over my resume. Like, my resume does not say I have 7 years. And we had this really awkward, like, 30 to 60 seconds of just looking at each other. And she just kind of goes and says, you're not the Robert I'm supposed to be speaking to. And I just kind of, I'm like, this has been fun. And she goes, well, do you want to finish? We're almost done. And I said, yeah. And thinking that, yeah, that was an exercise of, you know, just, you know, right. a practice interview. And then got a call about an hour later being like, hey, we'd like to give you an offer. Like, this is Rob Odin. Are you sure you got the right person?
Yeah, in fact, you should have double-checked the offer, made sure they didn't make it out to Rob Odin.
Yeah. You know, like, there's some Robert out there who is just like, who got a scathing letter about not showing up. And
right. At poor Rob. Oh, I hope he's doing okay. He's probably...
Me too.
Yeah,
he should be fine. He had like 7 years of compliance.
I'm sure. Thank you, Cam. You're right. That man's got at least 7 years of compliance experience. Rob, other Rob, if you're out there and you're still looking for a job, hit us up. We know some people. We do. We'll put you in touch with them. So I have a question. I've got a lot of questions, honestly. A lot of questions. So there's no shortage of folks with Air Force backgrounds in our community, as I'm sure you might know. Shout out to all those folks out there. Appreciate the work. But I want to talk about some more recent things, because we don't get a lot of opportunities to discuss architectural challenges from a data protection and a data privacy standpoint. So first, let's open up the conversation to our listeners with, like, just even defining what that role might entail.
Okay. So first and foremost, it's having an understanding of your system and understanding the ecosystem, if you will, where your data resides. So whether it's data that is generated by the company, given to the company, collected by the company, or even by the employees in the company. What is that data? What is that life cycle? Meaning its creation, its modification, its transference, its deletion, whatever you have to do, it's understanding. And understanding that it's not just the data, but the people who interact with the data, because there's different levels, even with stuff that is sensitive, whether it's for the government, like something that is regulatory constrained, something that is internally constrained, meaning so as the organization says, this is our secret sauce, or is it something that is, you know, sensitive outside of controls of people who are were authorized to use it. So understanding not just the data, not just the protections or the requirements of that data, but also the individuals who should have access to that, and almost sometimes more importantly, who should not, right? So my social security number is a legitimate requirement for a lot of departments inside of my company. It is not a requirement for the IT people or for the person in finance. So understanding that, yes, this information needs to be shared, and it needs to be either internally or externally to the organization, but that information does not need to be shared or controlled to other types. So understanding that, and then understanding the different states that data is in, such as structured versus unstructured. Are you part of a table or a database, or are you part of a document? And then that just kind of rabbit holes down to technological dependency. So if you understand the data, you understand where that data flows through. You understand who has access to the data. You understand the states in which that data resides. Then you can kind of start piecing in the technology, right? But all that technology really comes into what you're already doing, your workflows, the people who have access to it. And then finally, what are you actually, what's your end state or goal to do with it? So as an architect, your design is not to be in the nitinoids, right? That's your engineers, your administrators, your analysts. The architect is to like holistically look at an organization. You understand these main components for it. And then you go and say, where do we as an organization want to be? Whether that's a strategy for segmenting your data. So saying this data, like identifying segmentation, prioritization, and then protection. And that's where you go from a strategic 2 to 3 year look. So nothing's going to be done tomorrow, but like, where do I want to be? And then how do you develop the milestones to get there, which is looking at your policies and procedures for, again, for those workflows people access and the data that you collect and how long you collect and where you collect, the protections you have in place today and where it needs to be, so gap analysis, so people, processes, and then finally technology, whether you're leveraging the technology you've already invested or if you need to bring in new technology. And it anyone who says this is a single-person job is going to lie at you. I really is just a lot of conversations I have with a lot of people who are much smarter than me on their individual processes. And I need to pull that information, come together and say how we as an organization can move forward to kind of meeting those needs. And then with that is people who have contrary or contradicting needs for the data, like our ethics and privacy. They're going to be a lot more restrictive on who, what, when, and where that data can be versus some of our business units or versus some of the other organizations in ours that might have more of a liberal definition of where the data can be used by who and where. And so it's kind of finding that balance for giving the right amount of protections, but also allowing the right use to that information.
That's a very, very, very good description. There's some more threads I want to pull on, but let me first ask a follow-up question. Is there anything that Rob and Rob's team at L3 knows that others don't know? And I mean that question not in a "we're smarter than others" kind of sense, right? But like, we exist as a function such that we can get to the outcomes and objectives you just described. So there's this thing that we know about data and systems that it is our job to continuously educate them on. Is there, and maybe it's not one thing, but boil it down for me to the essence of the thing that Rob and Rob's team knows that everyone else doesn't know.
So first and foremost, it's not a technology problem. I want to start off with that. A lot of people, they'll hear the architect, they hear IT, they hear IT security, and their first thought is, I actually lead a data protection and a DLP and data categorization working group, right, for a lot of professionals, a lot of organizations. And that's number one myth you have to bust. This is not a technology problem. Data is the use and need and protection of data is a workflow. It is a people problem. Right, especially if the data is related to either an individual, an organization, or some type of restricted or sensitive information, whether related to an individual or something that an individual has value for. So again, trade secrets, intellectual property, regulated data, whatever have you. So it's more of a workflow problem than it is a technology problem, because everything that I can implement for technology, I should be able to implement first, much slower, much less effective, through a people process and a workflow. And then, so for us, the thing that I think that we do successful is we start for the actual business use and the, what is the workflow? What is that value? And taking, you know, one of the bad things about IT is that we sometimes come into the room that we're the smartest person in the room, right? We give off those vibes. Like, and that kills everything for everyone. No, you know, because of course the lawyer is going to think that they're the smartest person in the room. Of course the data analyst is going to think they're the smartest person in the room. And, you know, and for their specific areas they are. So it's coming into kind of saying like, look, I don't have all the answers. This is a workflow. This is my understanding. Please prove me wrong. That's something I think we feel really good about. We've done. Mm-hmm. The other part is the real value of data is the context in which that data is produced, held, the value of that information, whether that information is about an individual or about a product. And so understanding the context allows us to relook at those workflows to see, are they valuable? Are they not? Are they working? Are they not? And do I need to make incremental changes? Like, hey, something's magic is happening with here. So let me not get in the way. Let me just help and kind of augment that. Mm-hmm. Or is there a full on break and we need to completely rip and replace.
So at the start of that, when you said this isn't a technology problem, this is a people and a process problem, I was waiting for Cam to press the little button on his mixer pad there where the choir just rejoices and goes, hallelujah. It's like that.
I don't know if I have one of those.
Oh, man, I swear you
have one of those. Well, Cam, now you have to get one for the next one.
Now you do.
Well, yeah. I mean, we can give that a try.
He has one in post-production.
a little bit of that.
There we go. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. You mentioned something else when you were describing the overall role that I wanted to get hyper-tactical on.
Okay.
Threat modeling. It's not an activity I see show up enough in the data security world. It's one that, hell, it's taken a long time just for the application security world to really embrace it. And arguably, it's still not nearly as well embraced there. But, you know, AppSec is, as we look at it today, has been distilled to this very myopic, just kind of like, you know, web application domain. But it's,
Yes,
you're kind of shaking your head because, yeah, you're right. Like there is, well, all of the other systems, but that stuff tends to fall under more systems than it does like applications. But when you're talking about data in the context that you are, who has the right to have it, not have, right? There is privacy adds a very different authorization model to data and data workloads. And so even from a workflow perspective, especially from a workflow perspective, performing, and I'm just going to make up some words here, a data threat modeling exercise against those systems seems like it would make sense. Am I in a minority here with this thought process?
So with all models, the first question I ask is, what's your intended purpose? Mm-hmm. What do you want to get out of it, right?
Yeah.
Are you looking to look for gaps? Are you looking to look at where you should prioritize your analyst times? So, which is where I think threat modeling works really well, right? It's like I'm expecting, it is a way to create a hypothesis of how a potential either internal or external threat will happen onto either your system or your environment or your workflow, and then how would you respond? And or could you find the breaks to respond either quickly, efficiently? Are you going to have false positives? You know, all those things. That is great. My only concern is that I've seen threat modeling as like the MITRE ATT&CK model, where it's almost like a panacea for just it's tried to use for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Very targeted. Very. I know what I'm getting out of this, as well as. Is the juice worth the squeeze of filling it out? Because it's bespoke. You're not going to just download something off the internet and be able to like, ran this macro I got off the line and I can see what it is. It does take an intrinsic knowledge of your workflows, of the risk, of kind of the breakpoints.
It takes a Robin team, right? And that's that's exactly why I'm asking you this question. In fact, I've never brought this topic up before. And I think one of the other reasons why, again, even threat modeling and the most accepted use of it I've seen in digital security and cybersecurity has been in the application security space. The thing that you touched on is exactly kind of why I think part of that problem exists is there isn't really any products you can just click on and go and it does the thing. In fact, I know of two commercial threat modeling products, commercial, not to be confused with like the open source ones that like Adam Shostak when he was at Microsoft created, or the ones that Mozilla created. They are not easy to use in the sense that if you're not Robin his team, you don't have that intrinsic knowledge, it's hard to externalize that into a technology. That externalization of knowledge is very difficult. But let me answer a question you asked in there and then see if you can take me further down this path as someone who thinks that this should be part of the larger data security solution set. The thing that I would like to have as an outcome from a data threat model would be to identify data security requirements. And I mean by that is today a lot of data security requirements are largely based around who should have access and who shouldn't have access. And
it's gatekeeper very much. So like here's your RBAC or maybe ABAC if you're getting real fancy. Yeah.
Right. Right. And those types of boundaries tend to be overly permissive or overly
restrictive.
Restrictive. Thank you. Because they are being that myopic, right? It's like, yes, have the data. No, don't have the data. And so more granular data security requirements. A, that would be one. Two, real potential vulnerabilities to the data, right? So not just this, if the wrong people get it, then bad things happen and it gets out. Like, sure, we know that. But like, tell me what is one of the potential vulnerabilities to that data set. Now, again, some of these things, at least in my P-brain kind of tie back to, like, I'm thinking about, like, AppSec principles, right? Like, if there's an SQL injection in the system, then that would allow for that data to be externalized. From a data threat modeling perspective, I could look at that through the same lens and say, you know, well, this system is connected to a database and it takes in queries from that API, right? Like, I can still perform that exercise. So that's the second thing I want. I want real potential vulnerabilities to the data. The third I want is to be able to quantify that threat, right? Like, quantify the threat to that data. I want those three things. And I'll tell you that right now, I feel like we're lacking those things in data security in general. Yeah. And as a data security architect as well yourself too, the only thing I'm looking for is A, to shut me up, and B, tell me that I'm thinking about this, if not the wrong way, maybe there's at least another way to look at it and or start, and I should stop just shooting for that panacea.
But when I think setting, like, so when I was a consultant at Booz Allen, one of the biggest values I ever learned was setting appropriate expectations, right? And I think vendors fail at this because they say my solution, because they want to be relevant, right? They're like, look, I might not be perfect for you, but I'm going to try to sell it that way because I want to get my stuff out there, and then we'll fix it, right? We'll get our engineers are smart. They'll get the answer. I think there's a lot we can do with what the tools and capabilities that we have if the expectations are appropriate, right? If we're very we're very owning, yes, we know exactly. We want to do X, Y, or Z. Our biggest risk is, so let's say we take customer data, or we collect data, and that data is valuable for us to do some really either marketing, allows us to target our builds based off either applications or products that we're generating. This information becomes our intellectual property, becomes our traits, becomes our thing. Okay, as you mentioned, now let me know that value. How does that come in? How do I ingest it? How do I modify it? And what is the outcome from there? Yes, obviously, I want to control the access to that data and from hand and back. And that's really good for monitoring, especially if you want to, like, go after the fact, like, wait a minute, do I need to staunch the bleeding, or do I need to try to do an administrative or legal charge on someone? But the other part is data is going to leave your castles. Okay, then what do you do when the data leaves your castles? Is it going to places that you trust, secure? Are you protecting it with either encryption or some type of way to pull that back? Those are things that I think is possible, and to look at, as successful as, like, the MITRE ATT&CK framework has been for, like, incident response, which was, at its time, was told, you think about incident response 5 years ago. It was, well, we just need really smart people to come up and it's going to be bespoke solution all the way.
Yeah.
I think something like that is available for data protection, but it's going to have to be a little niche more than we want it to be for the types of data that we're collecting, for the environments in which we're using that data, and for the uses that we have that. And I think that's probably where we're going to be successful than trying to boil the ocean or try to make a solution that works for everyone.
That makes sense. And I'm going to reflect back what you said and tell me if I'm beating on the right track. It would be far more prudent to attempt to create data threat models for your organization and vertical than it would be for us as external parties to come in and try to put a big lens on that problem.
Or even if you had a very specific industry.
Pharma, for example, right?
Well, like, even pharma. If you knew, like, pharma has this particular problem, right? They have this ingestion for the data. This is how they handle it. And you're about 80% of the solution that most pharma organizations have this. Boom. Now you've got a beachhead in which you can have a product. You can modify it slightly to be able to meet, you know, you basically use an off-the-rack suit and you tailor it for a small fee to make it fit, look like a $2,000 suit.
Right.
But the first thing is you have to have a general size shape to modify down. And I think that's going to be really interesting and for industry as a whole, because here's the thing. I can't do my job unless industry comes up with unique solutions that I can use.
Right.
I am that tailor who goes into, you know, gets an off-the-rack suit and says, okay, boom, and I need to tailor it towards my organization. But I can't do that if the suit's too small or too big. right? There's some variation. I had to have at least an 80% solution. And to get that 80% solution, there has to be at least a common enough thread between that workflow or the type of information that's stared and sourced. And one of an easy way to do that is to look at heavily regulated industries, because they generally have to move data in a certain way, because how they were meeting their regulatory requirements is by going through gates. And if you could figure out a way to make that pain less, that I think is extremely beneficial. It gives something that's repeatable, and that whole remember the Titan scene, right? Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. If you can make someone, you can walk them through it slowly. Doesn't matter how many times I modify it, I'm there. If that makes sense.
Great movie. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, obviously. Like, it's not a podcast unless you reference a Denzel Washington movie, right?
that's a good one too, though.
I mean, if we get to Training Day, then maybe that we've gone to a different.
No. We can't end until we get to a Training Day. King Kong ain't got on this data security threat model. There we go. We got it out of our system. There it is.
For now.
That's right. It might work its way back in.
I'll go ahead and jump in. So
please.
I'm kind of curious on your take on this. Security and privacy.
Yes.
What do they mean to you personally? Like, when you hear security and privacy, what do they mean? Are they separate? Are they together? Are they intertwined? Are they, what do they mean when you hear them?
Well, you know what? If I could take a step back, it's like confidential and private, right? That's not the same word, even though it sometimes uses a synonym, right? Privacy, I usually feel, is more of an individualistic thing, right? There are certain pieces of information that I have or I own that I want to restrict. Confidential is usually, I need this information protected. This is intended to be shared, but it's intended to be shared to very particular individuals, organizations, mm-hmm. use cases. It's not public, right? Both of those are restricted pieces of information. But privacy and private usually means, to me, it's much more close hold to the chest. But we live in a world where us existing in a digital world exposes more of that privacy. And we have to trade out the mentality that it's more confidential than it is for privacy. And security is why confidentiality is part of the CIA triad, right? Not to be confused with the intelligence community, but, you know, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. But that confidentiality, right, is information is restricted to those who are authorized and have been granted permission to use that information. And the thing about privacy, there's information that was collected on me that I wasn't aware of, and now I feel violated. Now I feel like, this is, you shouldn't have that information about me. Then there's information that's confidential that says, look, I want to give this information to Gabe, but I don't want Cameron to know. And I might pass that information along, and I want to make sure that the information that when you're using it, when you're transferring it, and when you're storing it, only Gabe has access to it and I have access to it. And so that is where I think there's this view of security and privacy get butting heads, because to provide security, especially for networking endpoints, if I'm providing security for a company, I need visibility. I need context, which means I need to do and have awareness of activity, even from an employee standpoint or who interacts with my tools, at a level that most people at first would feel, this is someone who's getting into my personal bubble. What do you mean you're going to watch over my shoulder? You're going to do all these things? Whereas, look, this is confidential, but I am authorized to have access to that information because this is a work asset. This is a product that is being developed for the company. So that's where I don't know if that's answering your question, but it is how I view it, as that, look, I want to keep things that should be private, but I want to separate what is actually confidential and what should be private. Mm-hmm. But then I also ask for my employees, if you have private thoughts, if you have private communications, keep it in a private means. It's the whole thing with the Marines and the Facebook groups, right? They had some very private thoughts and private conversations that they thought were private, but were being held in an environment that anyone can collect. Mm-hmm. And same thing with employee monitoring, right? If you're communicating and you're saying stuff that's threatening to individuals, that could potentially expose the organization to a lawsuit, could potentially make the rest of the workforce feel uncomfortable, such as sexist, racist, homophobic, like whatever it being,
right?
That kind of language that might be threatening workplace violence. You might think that, where's my privacy? No, you had a confidential conversation, but there was other parties part of that. So I do ask people to be like, when you're thinking of privacy, think of like, if you're using a communication channel, do you own that communication channel? Or is that somebody else's communication channel? If that's the case, then you don't set the restrictions on who has access to confidential information. You're giving up that authority. You're giving up that control. So if something is private, like you're worried about that being shared, then keep it in that you control and you keep it private. You keep it in your bubble. I could go on a rant like
no,
that all day.
I
run into that a lot because of employee monitoring. Like when you're having to do. Now, I want to be in a situation where somebody, you know, there's a misunderstanding. And I can't tell you how many times when you're looking at either looking into an investigation that's related to an individual and something happens, it's the best feeling in the world that somebody got something wrong.
Right.
Something got took out of context. It was a saying. That actually isn't the case. And you can do it in such a way that the employee, their workforce, their supervisor, nobody's aware of other than your legal and, you know, the processes are followed. And so that a claim that was made in the past would open up an investigation, be very public, or, you know, start spilling out awesome gossip to where you can handle, to where you can contextualize and say, actually, here's what actually happened. And that never impacts that employee's reviews, their relationship with their coworkers, or anything. And it's settled and done. So the organization can protect itself and do due diligence. But yes, you're also protecting the individual themselves. And so, but people also believe things are private when they're confidential channels that they don't own the confidentiality controls.
They believe. That's the operative word. They believe. Yes. Yeah.
And are you communicating, right? Like, do people have an expectation of privacy, right? Or do they not? And are you communicating? And are you communicating why they should not expect privacy here? Or to what level should they either expect privacy or, as I mentioned, the confidentiality of their messages and of their communications? You have to put it in scope. And it does take communication. So you can change your perspective from being big brother to more big mother. Like, look, I have to take care of these things, but I'm not going to be slapping you and jumping on. Here's my balance. Here's my constraints.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to understand what they're walking into.
I wouldn't want to hold you responsible for answering the following question.
Okay.
But it does really, I mean, like I'm finding myself asking it as we're having this conversation. Why is it that anyone has any expectation of privacy in a digital world? I don't remember, right? Like in the physical world, there is very much like centuries of holdover of, we used to have actual privacy. Although, and I'm not a lawyer, but the constitution by which we live underneath holds no expectation of privacy. Like there's no explicit discussion about it. There are rulings from the Supreme Court about expectations of privacy within certain settings, but the Constitution itself is very explicit in not providing doesn't even allude to it. Doesn't even like whisper about it. But let's take the physical world out of that. Like the digital world has never been one where that is an expectation. And let's pull that back even further. I understand why grandma might carry over her physical expectations into the digital world, but why in the devil do organizations carry that expectation over? And again, I'm not holding you responsible for answering this.
No. So this one's actually really interesting, right? And let's make sure I'm not too loud.
I told you'd get fired up.
Yeah. but it makes sense, right? Think about, do you remember the case that happened with the cops in Baltimore, and they had their body cams on, and they were having investigations of racial profiling, right? They had body cameras. They had someone sitting in the back seat. And then they just called up, and then the sergeant is just like, hey, I see a bunch of young African-American men sitting on a corner. Go break them up. Go see what's going on. I can't do that. I don't have a – we'll make one up. And the investigation team from under the FBI – sorry, I'm blanking out on their name – was the attorney general's office that was doing the investigation on them. What's sitting there? So I think it's not so much as we just kind of like people get used to it. And then because they're not thinking about the collection, they're not thinking about like, hey, there's someone in here. There's things in here. Now, again, obviously that was a very bad, they should not have had that, you know, and it just showed kind of how they were. But even some, I use that example with someone like that is lose your job. You were under huge investigations. Like, there's no good that's going to happen about that. But you had someone sitting in that car with you. So there was no expectation of privacy. But because they were so used to those channels and so used to that, hey, this feels like I'm just talking to you and me. It became that collection, that monitoring, that over things becomes white noise.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you're like, hey, guys, I'm here. They're like, where'd you come from? Like,
right.
What, did you hear that? Like, yeah. Right. Like,
I've been here the whole time.
I was here. Like this. Like, yeah. And for computers, the same way, right? So, like, let's take channels like Slack or Teams. It feels personal. It feels like a text message. It feels like you and I are just having a private conversation. And the comfort level comes up. And I might share a GIF that's, you know, potentially might not, but you know, but all that's being collected. It's just because it feels secluded, but doesn't mean it is. And I think that's where people get in trouble. I think that's where people,
share
information that can get them, you know, can negatively impact them financially, such as identity theft, because they're like, oh, this is, you know, it's only me and you, and I'm sharing this information. It's only me and you and whoever's behind me that you can't see. Actually, so this is also something else that I did. I used to do with Safe and Secure, go to schools and teach elementary and middle school kids about cybersecurity principles. Really fun. And one of the exercises is to write something on a piece of paper and say, here's how the internet works. I want to give this secret to that person over there, boy or girl. And I want you to hand it to them. Because it's all interconnected. It's information doesn't go directly to a person. It goes from this person to this person. That's how we share information. And then usually I wait for somebody to look at the letter, right? And if they don't, I usually stop. I would stop it. But usually somebody would. I was like, oh, stop. Do me a favor. I want you to make a copy of that. Still pass it to them. And then you may stop somebody else who now somebody else wants to see what's inside of it. And you're going like, look, something you thought you were only sharing with that individual. Not only did you share over here, but now they can make copies. They can distribute it. That it's that trusted communication. Unless you own that trusted communication, meaning that I am directly to you.
Right.
There's not, but that's not how we natively think. We think if I'm sharing information with you, I personally think there's a psychology behind it, is that if I'm sharing information with you and if I feel that it's private, I'm going to kind of ignore that it's not the environment that's, right. You know, so that's why I kind of answer your question.
No, it's a very fair answer. There's so much more that's wrapped up into there, including learned behavior is what you touched on quite a bit there. And there's both the negative and positive learned behavior. There's the learned behaviors of, you know, this is how I've always done the thing. So I do the thing this way. And then there's the learned behaviors of, this is the way this thing has always impacted me, and it never has negatively, so I will continue to do the thing. Right. But fundamentally, I think what you're really touching on is my expectations are probably out of line, right? Like, I shouldn't expect the corporation to understand that when a packet goes from its external MPLS connection and it hits another one, that the packet is then wrapped by another thing and everything looks at it all the way down, right? Like, to your point, everyone's looking at the data all the way down.
Yeah.
And there are some things in between there just at a packet level. It's like, you can't see that, right? Because I've done something to protect that, right? But even so, there is, if you have created that thing that you can't see while I am watching, right? i.e. man in the middle of attack, then it still doesn't matter kind of thing, right? So it
unless
is,
I have your endpoint, which I gave you.
Right, right.
just like why I yeah. think probably all of us on here were probably using Signal or Telegraph or whatever your point-to-point encryption communication channel is, because Apple with, you know, their child porn scanner, mm-hmm. you know, really showed. Like, don't get me wrong. I am 1,000%.
Everyone's against it. That's why you use yeah. that. That's yeah, yeah. That's why you go to the yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Like, but
you want anything to go through that could even yeah. be slightly controversial.
You use that.
You say it's for the kiddies. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But yes, that's but you don't own Apple's communication. Apple
no. Owns yeah, Apple's yeah, communication. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, no, but to kind of go back to your point, like for like there does seem to be, and sometimes there are, that you can't have privacy and security in the same, you can't have both. And I disagree with that. I think you have to reset what is actually private and what's confidential.
Right.
And in that way, you can have a balance. But you do need, I should not be the best friends with privacy, because I should have a dissenting voice to say, have you thought about this? Now, don't get me wrong, I should have a professional relationship with privacy, and that there is a trust between us so we can streamline our communications. But I should never anticipate that privacy is just going to give me a blank check to do whatever I want to do. And our privacy checks us on every single level, questions everything. And as it should be from an organizational standpoint, because it keeps everything above board and it keeps everybody out of jail, which is what we all want.
I mean, yes.
Yes. I mean, personally, yes. You know, it's not a place I want to go. So,
no, no, it is not. That's fascinating.
That was one of my favorite responses to that. I don't think we've ever gotten to go that in depth for that question. So thank you.
I think about it, right? Because when you are dealing with them, especially for employees and the expectation of privacy, even though we give a warning every time they log in, they get a little about, yeah, you have no expectation of privacy. We have policies, we have an employee manual, and every place mm-hmm. I've worked at has done some similar things. There's still this like, oh my God, like you saw that? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, dude, you said it in a chat. Or, hey, we're able to go and say, they never said that. Well, how do you know? Because we can see where that was claimed that they said that, and they actually didn't. So, you know, because someone, have you ever heard of poison pen?
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a poison pen claim years ago, and the person thought that we didn't have, so it would be their word against this. We're like, well, we actually have the logs, and there's no rec. Well, you just didn't collect it. Like, no, we collect them. It's just not there. it's easier to prove a negative when you have what actually was said, and you can look for that didn't happen. So, but yeah, it's just an interesting challenge, and I mean that as a good one, because. Power corrupts and absolute corrupts absolute, right? You should be checked. You should have balances, because it's really easy that if you have a blank check to do whatever you want, it's really easy to start justifying minimal things to start impacting, you know, people, because the ends always justify the means.
Always.
So if you have something that does that little bit of a challenge, you have that expectation, and your employees communicating back to you being like, hey, this is a little creepy what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? You're not explaining it to me rightly. It makes you be a better practitioner and a better human, actually.
I think you touched on something else for me that,
okay.
at least in my brain, so we'll say it out loud. Those interactions and intercommunications and yep. of data sharing in general, whether it's amongst individuals or amongst organizations, corporations, let's focus on the latter. There okay. is, as it occurs to me as we're having this conversation, probably quite a bit more trust than we probably could equally allow, right? Which is to say, it's like, ah, I know this organization now. We have signed some agreement together. We're going to, you know, go into business together and sell widgets together. And that mm-hmm. and that almost creates this, well, we know them. They're obviously trusted because we have this other relationship. and those types of permissive trust, if you would, can't think of a better way to describe it, seem to contribute a lot to some of the data privacy issues that I certainly see. Here's a great example of that. Sharing information with an external party still largely relies on kind of traditional asynchronous encryption methods, right? Like very heavily versus, say, you know, a distributed secret sharing method like, you know, Shamir secret sharing algorithms. I'm getting super technical here, but for the following reason. One of those things implies a trust on all levels, right? Like Sally and Bob levels of trust. Like we just knew that they knew each other and we knew they knew everything about each other.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, me and some new technology partners. Like, yeah, we know each other, but we don't really know each other. More importantly, I don't know their data security practices intimately. And yeah, maybe ask for a stuff too. See, dog doesn't trust me. Dog doesn't trust me. And so he won again, just for everyone's edification. The mailman has been vanquished one more day, and he's triumphant.
You know, so that's an interesting one, right? So this is where, like, your IRM world comes into play.
Right.
Which has its own limitations, right? But the idea is that, am I just encrypting the method in which I deliver information to you? Or even if let's say I encrypted the data and I give it to you and I give you the key, it's just a delivery mechanism. I just want to make sure nobody else got this but you. But Gabe, once I give it to you, you can do whatever you want with it.
That's exactly the problem, yeah.
Yeah, versus information rights management or digital rights management or whatever we're going to call it tomorrow that Microsoft wants to rebrand. There comes and says, hey, Gabe, I gave you some information. But every single time you access that information, you have to check in with me. Mm-hmm. One, am I still cool with you having that information? Two, did I give you permission to share that information with Cameron or not? And yes, I want you to share it with Cameron, but I only want you to share it with Cameron one time. Or I only want you to share this element of the data that I share with you to camera. You can really get into the weeds of that, but that's the danger of it as well. Because a lot of times people want to deploy this at the enterprise level. How do I do this per business unit, per individual relationship, or do I give it to the employees? And if I give it to the employees, now you have to manage your how many relations you have at work, whether it's 50, 100, what have you. And then you're having to figure out, well, man, should I let Cameron use this, or should I only let Dave use? I mean, should only Gabe use this, or does it just ease you being like, yeah, let you know, I'm gonna give it to Gabe, and I trust Gabe; he can do it, right? So we still put it in the use. So there's some interesting things with that. I do think if when you look at information rights management, now there's some technical issues that if you ever put the data in like a air gap network that can't reach back out to authenticate, then it breaks the whole system. Unless you do some really interesting technical into the weeds stuff. But if you do it very surgical, hey, these or goes back to your points. Hey, these are some really sensitive information that we have. This information, we want to control not only who we give it to, but what they can do when they have it and how long they have it. And if I want to take that data back, I need to take it back. There's also something else that I think you covered on that I'd like to cover. We also have to get better at differentiating the data that we share and how we share that.
Yeah.
We do. We have a like, I just give Gabe everything. Does that mean I give Gabe my personal information? Or can I also share Cameron's secrets? Or do I share only my professional information? Or do I say some personal things about me as well? And that maybe the personal things, my relationship with Gabe is not to that level, and I don't want to give them to that. And I should reevaluate, should I share, just because I share my resume, I shouldn't share a dating profile, right? Like there's, but we, for data, unless there's somebody who's forcing that review, it goes back to you say, well, I have an NDA with them.
Right.
Of course I can share that information. Right. Versus having someone who checks like, whoa, guys, this is, yeah, we said you could share this information. But then again, you also get on the other side. If you're too granular with it, just like all security controls, a security control has to be workable. It has to go into the workflow and it has to be understandable by your general population. If you don't have that, people are going to circumvent it and you're going to have more security issues than if you had never had that security control in the first place.
You've given me an amazing amount to think about, but I did just also think about something else. Sharing Cameron's secrets. Here's the thing. Cameron is the one who does the secret sharing around here. So the question to you before Cameron extracts those secrets from you is there anything that we haven't touched on that you would, that you feel passionate about that we should absolutely make sure we at least call out today?
So one, we did talk about the adverse, the potential adversary relationship between security and privacy. And I think it as more competimates, right? So aerospace and defense, we have a competimate relationship with a lot of our peers, right? On some contracts, we're going head to head. I want to win this, not BAE or not Northrop. Some relationships, I'm either going to be the prime and I need to bring BAE or Northrop, or vice versa, I'm going to be the sub.
Mm-hmm.
We have a collaborative relationship that we both have different priorities. And I feel like for people looking at security and privacy, we are in the same space. We do have different priorities. We do have situations where our priorities are going to conflict with one another. And there has to be some kind of terms and agreement from there. But there's also numerous areas that we can collaborate and enhance on each other, each other's mission. Mm-hmm. So I hope anyone who just takes from this discussion is that the relationship, yes, should be more of a checks and balances versus a winner-takes-all adversary, which is sometimes it gets painted out to be. And then other than that, I would also we talked about, you know, understanding your own private versus confidentiality. And then the other from that is that we kind of talked about from a little bit more the insider threat. The same conversations people are having with when you share, protect, exchange information externally to your organization – we have a hard time, like, hey, this is my coworker, this is my person. But if you wouldn't lend that person $1,000, right, would you lend your coworker $1,000? And the question is not automatically like, absolutely. Then maybe your coworker. Like all your coworkers, right? Just because you work for me, would I just give you $1,000 and hope you pay me back, right? So there's, we already condition our trust that we have in the workforce. You're giving the most secret crown jewels of your information. If you, you know, it doesn't mean that you're on them, but you would follow up. You would make sure, like, hey, is this person, you know? And so when it comes to insider threats, a lot of times it can be painted as this big brother, like, we're coming after you. And it can be like, it's antithesis to privacy in general.
Yeah. But
it is merely a means in which organizations can look in and investigate either abnormal behavior, indicators of compromise, or a claim that was made by either an outside or internal organization. You'd much rather want to have a very detailed process and how your organization does that with the checks and balances that we talked about, privacy, legal, in the beginning, than trying to have people do it ad hoc. And that's what an actual insider threat program brings to the table. It's not, I'm going to spy on you. It is a systematic way that you look into those concerning behaviors in a way that meets the culture and the regulatory framework your organization finds themselves into. And I think that's just, it gets lost in the minutia because it's like, it feels icky, but you would much rather have that structure in place than people trying to figure that out when something big happens and then a lot of people get burned.
Can I get another amen clap at the end of that one? Can I just get another, maybe throw in an extra soul clap for me too while you're at it? Yeah.
It's, as you can see, it's a passionate area of mine. I love it, but it's
because you just said something. Yeah. You just articulated something that I'm not sure others have with regards to describing what an insider program, an insider protection program, should look like. And I think the reason your articulation of it really resonates so well with me, considering I'd not heard something even similar before, was because the thing that you accounted for was how that program should interface and interact with the data that it needs to make that program successful versus just, we will look at all the things for all the things kind of thing.
And it's easy to get down that path.
Yeah.
And,
so,
So when I was with the – oh, I probably should have mentioned this. Earlier in my career, I was with the National Insider Threat Task Force.
We should warn you. We can edit this show, but we try not to. So,
okay.
Don't say the things.
Don't say the things, or
well, no, I mean, yeah, no. Take the precautions you were going to take because.
No, you don't own the recording platform. No. My apologies. I said I should have said this earlier.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was something you were like. I shouldn't share.
It's on my LinkedIn. I had a DNI.gov account.
Very good. Very good.
So, prior to coming to L3Harris. I was with the National Insider Threat Task Force, which was a presidential task force set up by the Obama administration with Executive 13587. And I was their cybersecurity center matter expert, which worked with establishing insider threat programs for federal departments and agencies. So about 250 federal departments and agencies, you know, for the United States government. And working on that, and one of the key elements that the director of the my former boss, who's now the director, Bob Rohr, and the rest of leadership was saying, legal has to be in the room from day one. Your policies and procedures have to be in the room for day one. If you do this, that it comes, if your employees, regardless if it is or is not, believe that you're doing a witch hunt, you have your program's going to fail.
Screwed. Yeah.
You're just going from there. So the idea is that people should understand, hey, what are we looking? Why are we looking at? What do we do? And so communication, being able to say, here's what we do for you, and how you can leverage us if you have concerns, either for yourself or others, along with, you know, protections in place that you don't get burned by doing the right thing. It's been something that was ingrained in me, and it's something that I feel very passionate about because I do think a lot of times it's very scary. People don't understand, and organizations are missing a golden opportunity being like, look, this is not against you. This is for you. This is for the organization. I know that sounds PR as it can be, but when you look at what is the alternative, and that's where, especially if it's ad hoc, especially if I have to start asking questions, especially if it starts getting to a point that if money's stolen, I got to look for it. Right.
Right.
if data is taken right. out, I got to look for it. You right. would much rather have that process that I can contextualize the incident as frictionless as possible so that poison pens or a misunderstanding does not have negative consequences. And if you don't have an established program, those are things that can happen and do happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, Rob. Your passion for that topic in particular is flipping awesome. We'd like to extend an invite back to talk about that insider threat in particular. Like, okay. let's just spend some time digging deep on that because,
cool.
yeah, there's just so much there that I think both from your background and your knowledge as well as your passion would really help come out. So let's do that. Let's consider this an open invite. We'll figure out round two with Rob because that was just dope. But it is time to extract the secrets. We have our vase. To make you talk. The secret is just ask
deep, dark secrets. Not really dark, but they can get a little dark. Let's start off with a good one, though. Because everybody wants to know about Rob and his situation inside of his bathroom. How does your toilet paper roll go on to the roll? Is that what it's called? Yeah. Is it, do you pull it over or is it under?
Nobody likes a mullet. Okay, so it goes over to go down.
I think a lot of the what is it Gen Zs? They're all wearing mullets now.
Yeah, I have a 17-year-old daughter. I'm like, when did the late 80s, early 90s come back? And yeah, there it's mullet. It's the big.
Yep. Visor glasses.
Yeah.
I don't mind anything from those eras with one glaring exception. The mullet.
Yeah.
So
I don't mind the platform.
When are the starter jackets coming back?
That's a good question.
Because I'll rock that look out again.
What year was the bomber jackets? Like those really
late 80s. Late 80s.
Late 80s?
Yeah, late 80s. Yeah.
Those are definitely coming back.
And in the early 90s is when everybody, for no reason that we can explain, all head starter jackets.
Yeah, I'm. Man, there's a photo in here. I was literally showing someone the other day. Yeah, I'm not even gonna lie. Like, I'm straight up wearing one.
Hey, man, I got a Saints starter jacket because that's my mama's family's from New Orleans, and yeah. You know, like, it was like, boom, here you go.
Yeah, go Saints for beating the Pats. That's, thank you for doing that yesterday. That was great.
Is it really beating the Pats if Brady's not there?
Ooh, yeah, that's a truth. Yeah.
It's a truth to that.
Well, that'd have been like, beating Brady,
beat Tampa
though.
Bay. If they haven't beaten
Tampa
Bay.
Hey, man, I'm in Florida. Okay. So there it's people love. I mean, you got to give Brady. He's
definitely winning the relationship.
Yeah.
He's winning.
Yeah.
All right. I got one for you. What mythical creature do you wish actually existed?
Okay, so I'm a huge fantasy nerd. Dragons, obviously. It's
good choice.
Flying,
yeah.
Destruction, but awesomeness. I don't mean like the Eastern European, like snake with legs. I mean like full.
Oh yeah.
Lord of the Rings. You know, lizard with huge
dragon.
Wings. Yeah, dragon. Fire breathing dragon. Yeah. Horde of gold. Yeah.
That's a good choice.
Yes. Yeah.
Probably one of the coolest mythical creatures for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. If someone narrated your life, who would you want that to be narrated by?
So I made a joke about this. Okay, so I'm from South Alabama, and okay. I had like a trailer park in South Alabama, like for parts of my childhood. So there is a joke to my friends, like, I don't see anyone other than Billy Bob Thornton doing like my, just because I feel like he has like the right mix of being like, he spent some time in the park, but yet got out.
Yeah.
But you can still hear it in the back of his voice. Like, just don't care. Like, that is who I feel like if you're going to do an autobiography of my life, like, that's
I'm pretty sure a lot of his characters, like the one where he plays the drunk coach
Santa.
For the Bad News yeah. Bears, and then the Bad Santa, of course.
Yeah.
So, definitely. What if I suggested John Paul Tremblay? Folks might have to Google that. It's Julian from Trailer
Sounds
Park
familiar.
Boys. Julian from Trailer Park.
Oh. Boys. I know what you're talking about.
He's got the voice. He's got a similar facial hair kind of thing, although he looks a little different. But anyway.
I like the choice, though.
I like John Paul, but I love your choice. Your choice is a good one.
Well, so it's bad because a lot of my friends like clowned on me from, like, you know, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
I've seen it, yes.
What's the guy's name?
I've not seen it enough to name names.
It's not the brother, but it's the other dude, like the tall one. He wears beard. My hair is like the same.
Yeah. So
I get the.
I know who you're referring to. He's the guy from the Pepe memes. I don't know his name. Yeah, I'm bad.
He's
at
not
this.
The short one, but yeah.
I'm bad. At
not
this
blinking.
Game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sorry. I like it.
We'll come back to it if you remember.
Yeah. I'll bring it up on the next one.
There you go. That's right.
Rob,
hold something.
What's one application in your phone that you have to use, but you dislike?
Besides my Outlook for work.
You can say Outlook.
It is so bad to write emails through there. It is so bad. You can't ever get the, like, if you make a, try to edit it and you try to slide the little, you can't get it in the right place. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. I well, cause the thing is, I also implemented Azure Information Protection, which is a data categorization, right? It allows you to do that segmentation we talked about. And it shows, but it's not really the same. And so it kind of conflicts. So yeah, it's my Outlook in my app is just, I just rather just see the message and then go into my office and just type it out because everything else is fine. But yes. That's why I even have, like, sent from my iPhone, please don't judge, message on the bottom if I'm sending something.
So I moved into the world that you have, which is to say, like, I'm even, like, my next phone, I'm going down to a smaller version. Like, I don't need large screen size anymore. You know why? Because of what you just described, I'm done trying to respond to things with that level of frequency from my mobile device because it's just, it's too hard, it's too difficult, to say the least of. I don't want to have to send emails 19 hours a day any longer. So I'm going down a small form factor because all I'm going to do is exactly what you said. I'm going to read it
And if I need to do something about it, I'll go to another device.
Flag it or
about it. Flag yeah, later. Like it's ridiculous, though.
Well, I actually do have the pro, right? Because I do a lot of reading. Like my Audible is when I'm jogging. But for like the Amazon Kindle books,
yeah,
mm-hmm. I read it off the phone. But yes, I hate responding, so I just like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even at that size. I feel like even I even have a tablet for the kids, and even that I hate. I'm just like, give me a keyboard.
Typing a message with your fingers is not, it's just not, I mean, like that. Not yeah. like.
I think yeah. about how many years I've spent doing that, and I'm annoyed with myself. Like, having been in this as long as I have been, and been even like a very early BlackBerry user, like the number of minutes and seconds and hours of my life I've lost to responding to things on a mobile device is officially
too actually good. The best is what I started doing, and this is what my my neighbor started doing. There's the not to talk to text, but you can just record your voice to respond to someone on chat, and Apple does it good. I love that now. All right, if I need to like, if I can just do a quick response, okay, cool. But if there's like something I want to explain, but I don't want to actually have an actual conversation with the person, like give me the 5 to 10 seconds, it's changed.
Just
my
record mind. It. I have
just
a friend.
Record it.
Are you yeah, just talking yeah. about when you're in the text message thing? You just
yeah,
hit the
you
little
just record
microphone.
It and it sends it as an audio file. I have one friend in particular who uses that.
I need to start doing that.
Yeah,
man. I'm gonna tell you, like, don't get me wrong. It gets annoying when it's just like they almost feel like they need to fill the space.
Right.
I talk a lot, so I understand the need, but you know, like, let's. It gets annoying, but if you're like, I want to explain this, but I need like the inflection of my voice. I need to like something explained, but I also don't want to be on the phone with you because I don't want to spend a couple minutes to do right. the niceties
sure.
to just explain
sure.
this. It's that whole click, click, yeah. whatever the, yeah.
So this segment of the show is Deep Dark Guest Secrets, not mine, yeah. but I feel compelled to spill one in particular because I'm an absolute idiot. I don't like recording my voice into those things. I don't use Siri. I don't use the talk thing on my remote. I don't use any of that. But meanwhile, I record ungodly numbers of hours of myself, including this podcast, on any given week, every week without fail. But I refuse to talk to those devices. I'm like, no, I won't. I won't talk into them.
I won't do it.
I won't do it. I don't want it to have my voice. I won't talk to it.
I get frustrated because my 5-year-old, like, I try to tell, like, we have an Alexa speaker
yes,
in our kitchen.
Yes.
Never understands me. Speaks my 5-year-old who has his little 5-year-old voice. Doesn't matter what she says.
Picks up on it.
Picks it up perfectly. Yeah. Like plays exactly what she wants to play.
Yeah.
And I'm just
That's not an accident. It knows.
I'm like you're doing to me, this to me. Yeah,
it knows
yes,
that your 5-year-old has more disposable income than you do.
That's true.
Yes, Daddy will buy all the things for her. Daddy will buy nothing for himself, but for her, we'll open up the wallet.
That's painfully accurate.
Rob, let's say you're kidnapped.
Okay.
And I thought quickly went along with that. Okay, sure.
Okay, I'm ready.
So I've been to some pretty shady places in the world, so that's not yeah. like a I've been to places where I had to get briefed.
Wait, you've had to think about this actual scenario. Like,
yes,
oh my God,
like,
I thought about this.
Yes.
I thought about this already.
Yeah, go like you like so for some of the work I did with the federal government, like, look, you're gonna be a target. So, you know,
right.
take it like a man.
Yeah.
But don't be a hero, because people who hero die. So
right.
yes, please let's yes. see what your if I'm kidnapped question.
Okay, it's not gonna be what you think.
yeah, apparently.
Let's
not.
Just say
let's just say
you're kidnapped. Okay.
Okay.
And the people that are coming to save you are the last TV of the cast of the last TV show you watched.
Hmm. Well, it depends.
Mm.
The last TV was actually an Amazon animation. It's the superhero one.
Teen Titans? No.
No. It's like the really
what if?
Adult.
What if? No.
Not what if.
Oh.
Man. It's
I think I know what you're referring to, but I don't know
Unbreakable or something
it.
Like that.
Yeah.
Undefeatable, like something like that. And I'm completely blanking on what it was. I don't actually get a chance to watch all that TV because of the kids. But
it's fair.
Like Unlimited or something like that. But yeah, it's the one where it's a half human and he's figuring out he has superpowers. And
so yeah,
if I'm doing that, but then there's the other side of that. That's the evil people. So it depends which side is coming for me. If I get the pick, yeah, I'm good. The other side,
That works though. That's perfect. If it's
yeah.
Good.
No, I was gonna say I gotta figure out what show that is. It sounds fascinating though.
Wait, oh, it's got the guy from Spider-Man. Like, give me the pictures of does the voice and continues for that. He's the voice of
Amazon Prime original.
Yeah.
I'll find it.
So I've also learned something else about Rob today, which is I can't choose him as a trivia partner, largely because he's as bad as I am with movie and TV. So like we would just lose together, like in stylish fashion. So this is good to know. This is good to know.
Yeah.
Well, Rob, I just want to thank you for taking the time. obviously, you're super passionate about everything that you do, and I think your background is just pretty amazing. So we really appreciate you coming on and talking about it. And we hope you take us up on that offer to come back on and have that deeper discussion. But thank you for your time. Seriously. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great conversation for our guest this week. Absolutely fabulous. Indeed. You broke down some concepts, I think, in ways that are new to our listeners. So thank you very much for that. Love having practitioners on, and I couldn't think of someone better this week. So, Rob, an absolute pleasure. As my counterpart here, Cam, mentioned, we want you to come back on the show. We want to spend some time on the threat intel. We'll let you take us out today.
Okay. Awesome. Well, appreciate it, gentlemen, for having me on. This is a lot of fun. I think having these type of discussions, one, it exposes multiple sides to it, and as well as I love the questions because it makes me think about how I'm approaching it myself, and makes me a better practitioner. So no, I'm super excited to be on. More than happy to jump on again, and hopefully hear some feedback from the audience of, hey, did they like this or not like this for topics focus? Just for my own kind of personal development. So thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely, we will make sure we share that feedback. Thanks again.
I just wanted to thank all of you out there for tuning in each and every week, and to all of our amazing guests for coming on. I know that there are millions of other shows, and it means the world to have you with us on this journey. We are so grateful that you choose to listen to us each and every week. If you like the show, tell a friend, have them tell their friends, and then maybe make some new friends along the way. So we can continue to spread the word and keep learning together. Let's protect what matters most. And by the way, DJ, can you go ahead and drop that outro beat and keep it classy? We'll see y'all next week.